using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
It's Tuesday, the 22nd of June, year of our Lord, 2021, day 465 of America Held Hostage. Well, today we're going to be joined by Eric Peters, and we're going to talk about what is happening with all things green, how they're working to take away our automobiles, our meat, and everything else. The good news is that Switzerland just renounced that, and it was led by the millennials and the Zoomers, who, when it comes to taking things away from them, they actually start to pay attention. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I want to begin, however, with the next generation that has been wiped out long before we had the toxic vaccines pushed on us by the government. We had abortion pushed on us by the government. And we had a couple of questions put out by various reporters from CNS News. First, it was Julia Johnson who asked Nancy Pelosi, "Is an unborn baby at 15 weeks a human being?" And if you recall, yesterday, I showed you a picture of a baby born at 16 weeks a year ago. Just celebrated his first year anniversary. Look at how tiny that baby is compared to the woman's hand. And yet, notice, if you can see that picture, everything, all the details, all the human details, down to the fingernails, down to the fingerprints of a 16-week-old baby. Now, Pelosi ducked the question, is an unborn baby at 15 weeks a human being? She said, let me just say this, I'm a big supporter of Roe v. Wade. And why the 15-week number? Well, because you have a new law that has been passed, not that new, but it's put out by Mississippi, saying that they would stop abortions when the child is like this age. And how outrageous is that, say Nancy Pelosi? And, of course, Joe Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki, was also asked the same question by another CNS News reporter. Does the president believe that a 15-week-old unborn baby is a human being? That was Melanie Arder. The other reporter for CNS News was Julia Johnson. Good for them. Are you asking me if the president supports a woman's right to choose, said Psaki. Well, he does. You see how they spin this? Let me tell you what Roe v. Wade is. Roe v. Wade is a power grab by the Supreme Court. Roe v. Wade will not be overturned. I am absolutely certain that Amy Coney Barrett and enough of these judges, specifically what she had to say in the hearing, she's supposed to be a Christian. They were concerned that she was going to overthrow Obamacare and Roe v. Wade and other things like that. Make no doubt about it, she wouldn't do anything to Obamacare, and so they certainly are not going to do anything to Roe v. Wade. She even made the point that they would not address Roe v. Wade because it is the law of the land, but it might be adjusted around some of the perimeter issues. See, the key thing for Roe v. Wade is that it has given the Supreme Court more power than they've ever taken upon themselves, taken, since Marbury versus Madison. That they can rule on anything and everything for which they have no authority, that they can create laws, and they're not about to let that go, not even the most conservative of them. It's not about to let that go. Not even if that, in order to get that power, the Supreme Court has had to kill tens of millions of babies. Do you understand that? Do you understand how important power is to these people, that they will allow tens of millions of babies like this and older because the Supreme Court said this is a 16-week-old baby. The Supreme Court said that you can kill babies up to 24 weeks. Do you realize how much more developed a child is at that? So that is the price of power. These people who want power will give you toxic vaccines for the money involved. And again, that baby was only 11.9 ounces, not pounds, ounces, 11.9 ounces, not even 3/4 of a pound. So, and the parents, again, made a long commute every day because the hospital would not allow them to stay overnight in the hospital because of, you know, COVID. So they did that for months, made a daily commute for months, and celebrated that baby's one-year anniversary. Let me just say this. What the president supports, what Biden supports, what Jen Psaki supports, what Nancy Pelosi supports, is not a woman's right to choose. They support Planned Parenthood's right to deceive and to murder for profit. That's what they support. And President Trump supported giving them $135 million. They made out like bandits under his PPP. And that was supposed to be for small businesses. But of course, he changed the rules to make sure that his hotels could get the subsidy. And the money all went to the big institutions like the Trump hotels and Planned Parenthood. Why? Well, because they also incentivized that in the loans. After they said, well, we're not going, was originally going to be for companies that have fewer than 500 employees. But then they said, well, we'll make it just so that it's fewer than 500 at an individual location, which opened this up to virtually all the companies. And then they based the fee that the banks would get. They had the banks as the intermediaries, of course, handing out the money, as they always do. And the banks got fees based on the amount of money that was given to an organization. So that incentivized them financially to give the money to the big corporations and not to the small ones. Just as Trump incentivized governors, Republican and Democrat, to do the lockdown, as he incentivized medical malpractice with the bonuses for diagnosing somebody with COVID. Not even with a PCR test, just a clinical diagnosis. You say they got COVID, we put that in our statistics, and we cut you a check for $13,000 right there. And if you don't give them any of the cheap over-the-counter effective medication that would stop this, and you let them get worse and worse, and you put them on invasive intubation with a respirator, and they die, we'll give you an even more. We'll give you $39,000 for that. So the laws, the Mississippi Gestational Age Act, passed in 2018, but a court said, sorry, you can't do that because it conflicts with the Supreme Court's edict, Roe v. Wade. And so they're waiting for that to come around. You have Greg Abbott signed a bill last week that would ban all abortions in Texas, except with this caveat that would take effect, that law. This is just virtue signaling yet again from Greg Abbott. Here's a law that's going to ban all abortions. And then you read the fine print and it says, within 30 days after Roe v. Wade is overturned. Mm-hmm, exactly. So when we look at this, as we were talking about this yesterday, and I had one individual respond to me who was a Catholic. I was talking to Al Waddell about what's going on with the Baptists primarily, but he also got into what's going on with the Catholics. This Catholic site, LifeSite News, says the Vatican Academy is going to co-host pro-vaccination conference with secular medical associations. And so what I said to her, I said, it doesn't matter whether these people, these leaders, call themselves popes or they call themselves presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention or whether they're presidents of universities or whatever the title of Franklin Graham is. You have people like Franklin Graham, Al Mohler, Robert Jeffress, who are cheering the vaccine just like the Pope. And you have these organizations that are pushing social justice just like the Pope, just like the liberation theologists in Central and South America that the conservative Catholics have known for a long time are nothing but Marxist Jesuits, and that's where this Pope comes from. Why are we allowing, and this is what I said, this is my message to Catholics, to Baptists, to United Methodists, to Presbyterians, to anybody and everybody, all you Christians out there, anybody who is listening, who says that they're a follower of Christ, who believes that they're following Christ, why are you following these human institutions? Why are you following these massive top-down institutions, these man-made institutions, these perverse institutions that have corrupted and are corrupting from the top down, misleading people? You need to understand that it's not all that complicated to follow Christ. You'll find what you need to know about him, not from listening to these political leaders who are embracing the use of aborted babies to create medicine, making excuses for that. That's not something that is limited to any of these massive human institutions. You can see it from Al Mohler. You can see it from Franklin Graham, from Robert Jeffress. Instead, if you're a Christian, you need to hold to the faith that was once delivered. It is complete. It is sufficient. You'll find it in the Bible, and you don't need these massive institutions. What you need is to dig into the Bible. Ask God to open this up to you and have a local church that is autonomous from these people. But you'll find the pattern for the church in the Bible. You'll find the plan for salvation in the Bible. And you don't need these other institutions. They're perverted. You'll find everything you need for your relationship with God and for man in there. You don't need social justice. You need justice. And even more than that, you need mercy. So, when you look at this, are you going to follow these leaders, these popes, these presidents of colleges and denominations who have absolutely no discernment about this in the most charitable understanding of this? The most charitable way that we could look at this is that they are jumping into something for which they know absolutely nothing about and cheerleading for it. In spite of the massive amounts of information that is out there, if you're going to be a leader, you'll be held to a higher account. You better read if you're going to lead. And so if instead of following these leaders, why don't you read the Bible, and then maybe you can lead. It's not that difficult. So we have the Biden administration now putting out more red flag laws. Again, I pointed this out yesterday. It's a model legislation, the same thing that they did back in 2001 after the simulation 2 months before 9/11, the false flag 1 week after 9/11 with the anthrax attack, and then the model legislation 2 months after that. That's how we set up the patterns for these public health officials to do this to us, what they've done the last 465 days. And so now they're doing the same thing with red flag law. They have model legislation that they're sending out. As Reason points out, this belies the Justice Department's avowed commitment to due process. Now, I find that surprising because I've never seen the Justice Department say that they have a commitment to due process. Did Biden say he was going to do that? Well, that's what they say. They said he promised in April that the Department of Justice would abide by due process. Since when has Biden ever abided by due process? When has he ever embraced the principle of God-given rights? He has always opposed that. I said that going back to the Clarence Thomas hearings. He was adamantly opposed to the concept of natural rights, the foundation of America, the idea that each of us is created equal. And we're not talking about equity. We're not talking about equal results. We're talking about equality of opportunity, equality before the law. And that means more than anything, due process. He had a problem with that idea. And of course, because he has a problem with that idea, Biden has been the author of all the worst regulations surrounding the unconstitutional UN, United Nations War on Drugs. The mandatory minimums, the civil asset forfeiture, the massive imprisonment. He's also been at the epicenter of the assault weapon bans. And so now here he is pushing model red flag legislation. But who modeled that for him? Wasn't that Donald? Wasn't that Donald Trump? He said you just take the guns and do the due process later? Wasn't Donald Trump that did gun control by executive order? And so now we see Biden doing red flag by executive order, banning attachments by executive order, just like Donald Trump set the precedent. And we could call him, we could call Trump the former precedent instead of president. That's what he is. He is the former precedent of gun control. The proposed language describes a process that is rigged against respondents from the beginning to the end, allowing courts to strip people of their Second Amendment rights based on little more than bare allegations by potentially mistaken, biased, or malicious petitioners. The Justice Department pays lip service to due process, just like Trump, and to protecting the rights of law-abiding Americans, but it acknowledged the possibility of false or harassing applications for gun confiscation orders. Every state with a red flag law allows ex parte orders, which means that a judge issues without prior notice or hearing. Those orders, which authorize gun confiscation, prohibit the respondent from obtaining new firearms. Typically, they last for 2 to 3 weeks, at which point the target finally gets a chance to rebut the allegations, which means that the term respondent is really a cynical misnomer. Despite the obvious due process problems this policy raises, the Justice Department is agnostic on the question of what the legal standard should be. This model language says that a judge, quote, shall issue an emergency ex parte extreme risk protection order, unquote, when the petitioner provides specific facts establishing probable cause to believe the respondent poses a significant danger, an extreme risk, or something else, but it doesn't define those terms, as the reason points out. Unlike most state laws, the DOJ language does not require that the risk be imminent. And you might think that would be a basic requirement for an emergency order based on a premise that there's no time for this. We've got to take the guns and do the due process later because it's an emergency, except that it doesn't require imminent risk. And again, why is that surprising? Because we are doing mass vaccination of teenagers now who have no imminent risk from this coronavirus. They have always made the case. The teenagers have zero risk from this virus. And yet they're going to give them an emergency ordered vaccine ordered by Trump. This is an emergency use authorization. There's no emergency for teens, except to stop them from getting this injection. We have an interesting article from RT. The guy's name is Tom Secker, and he and another person, whose name is Matthew Alford, co-authored a book called National Security Cinema. And we're not talking about the TSA. That is security theater. That's just at the airports. No, no, no. This is security theater that you pay to watch. Predictive programming being used to move public opinion. And so they wrote a book about this. And they had done a FOIA request about the Ben Affleck picture, Argo. It came out in 2012 and they'd forgotten about it. He says my co-author was really surprised when he received these. He didn't know what it was. It took him 8 years to respond to his Freedom of Information request, information about the CIA's connection to Hollywood with the picture Argo. Ben Affleck did this based on the real-life CIA operations to exfiltrate 6 embassy staff trapped in Tehran following the 1979 revolution. And it was a big publicity win for the CIA. I've talked about this many times in years past, the fact that the CIA has its own, quote, this is what they call it, entertainment industry liaison page. I had a friend from high school that I knew that was actually in that area for the Pentagon, for military stuff. If you do what they like, if you write scripts and going to do movies that are friendly to them, they will give you access to all kinds of military equipment to make your movie. And if your narrative is hostile to them, they'll do everything to block it from you. And so the CIA does the same thing, of course. And the CIA, being creative as they are, has their own stories available for writers on their website. At least they used to years ago when I did this. And when they looked at, you can look at the scripts that they have crafted together, the narratives that they want you to push. And they will also offer to help you to make your movie more CIA friendly. Who knows how much money is behind that, right? So, as they point out, you have in Argo, it's Ben Affleck. He commented in one interview, he said, probably Hollywood is full of CIA agents and we just don't know it. And when he was asked if he was working for the CIA, Ben Affleck replied, I am, yes, and now you've blown my cover. Ha, ha, ha. Well, maybe it wasn't so much of a joke. You know, I've talked to Steven Schellenberger before, and he talked about how connected the CIA was throughout Hollywood. We talked about the writer with no hands. Do you remember that? The writer who was poking too deeply into what was going on in Panama and the Bush family and just disappeared one day. He was threatened, then disappeared. The very curious circumstances under which they found his car about a year later. And his hands had been removed. He was a friend of Steven Schellenberger. And Steven Schellenberger also talked about how he had started Lionsgate, but it got taken over by a guy that he knew that was kind of a partner in that, whose dad was very connected with the CIA, with all these spooks. So, and Steven Schellenberger is a guy who works for the Pope. Steven Schellenberger's understanding, and of course he became a targeted individual for talking about that. But he understands how deeply this is in Hollywood inserted. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll tell you the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project, to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.
I'm Jennifer Garner. I play a CIA officer on the ABC TV series Alias. In the real world, the CIA serves as our country's first line of defense in the ongoing war against international terrorism. CIA's mission is clear and direct: safeguard America and its people. And it takes smart people with wide-ranging talents and diverse backgrounds to carry out this mission. People with integrity, common sense, patriotism, and courage. The kind of people who have always worked for the agency. But since the tragic events of 9/11, the CIA has an even stronger need for creative, innovative, flexible men and women from diverse backgrounds with a broad range of perspectives. Right now, the CIA has important, exciting jobs for U.S. citizens, especially those with foreign language skills. Today, the collection of foreign intelligence has never been more vital for national security. If you're an American citizen and seek a challenging, rewarding career where you can make a difference in the world and here at home, contact the agency at www.cia.gov. Thank you.
All right, and so that's Ben Affleck's former wife. She plays a CIA agent, and she's also a CIA recruiter in real life, as you just saw that there. And they don't just need people who speak foreign languages. They need people who speak the language of Hollywood, who can craft a narrative and turn the CIA from villain to hero. And that's exactly what Ben Affleck, her husband, was able to do. This article, again, from RT. Argo was supported by the CIA. Affleck had previously worked closely with the CIA when he played Jack Ryan in 2002, The Sum of All Fears. The person he worked with at the time, the CIA Hollywood liaison, Chase Brandon, said one of the things I think benefited Ben as he walked around the agency was simply to feel the atmosphere of the place. There is a very palpable sense of evil. Mission and importance to what goes on there. I got a story here about Stonehenge. And it just made me think of that when I was thinking about walking around the CIA. When Karen and I walked around Stonehenge on one cold, isolated January in 1980. It was just the two of us. It's out there in this isolated place. It took a bus trip out there. It was freezing cold. And we're the only people there, and they did not have the kind of, you know, blocking people from getting to anything there like they do now. So you could just walk through there, touch the stones or whatever. People started putting graffiti and carvings on them, and so they started blocking that. But they didn't at the time. And it was kind of eerie. I was interested in it because I had done a report about the building of Stonehenge, the construction, the architecture of it. When I was in elementary school, so I'd always wanted to go see it. But she was noticing just how evil the place felt. And I said, yeah, I can kind of see that as well. So I could imagine if you're walking around the CIA, you kind of get that same feeling. But he didn't. It was a sense of mission, he said, and an importance as to what goes on there. And I think Ben picked up on that simply by being in the building. Likewise, again, his wife, Jennifer Gardner, did that. Well, details about how they worked, again, as I was pointing out before the break, were released as part of a FOIA request after 8 years. And so these guys who had written a book about national security cinema, the shocking new evidence of government control in Hollywood, said, well, this is what we found. It's kind of interesting. And he says, I was kind of confused when the documents came through the door. I'd totally forgotten I'd done this. And so he said, when they started going through the documents, they found that it had been in the works for a while, this particular picture, Argo, through George Clooney. Oh, by the way, it's a good film. You know, they tell a good story. It's just the narrative that it puts out there. It wasn't until Warner Brothers invited Affleck to join the party that the project really took off. He worked very closely with Tony Mendez, the former CIA officer who Affleck played in the film. And the main idea behind this was to disguise the embassy staff as Hollywood movie crew. And so they make a movie about the CIA pretending to be Hollywood. And so Hollywood does that, pretending that they're not the CIA. You know, you can go there, you can get all these scripts. I don't know who writes the scripts for it. Maybe it has something to do with, maybe Pachinik has a hand in that, you know. Except I think his scripts are a little bit too absurd, even for Hollywood. the blockchain watermarks and the sting and so forth. Yeah, there you go. That would be an interesting scenario for Hollywood. Nobody would take it seriously, except InfoWars. Anyway, in March 2011, Affleck and Mendez went off on a tour of the old Naval Observatory, the former headquarters of the CIA, as well as its predecessor, the OSS. The tour was arranged by the U.S. State Department and the CIA, followed by a visit to Langley for a roundtable in the director's conference room. Whoa, I mean, we're at the throne here of the world empire. Seriously, this is a real government. I mean, he's at the headquarters of the real government of the United States. That's got to be a heady trip for him. An internal email outlined how the CIA were, quote, hoping to develop a close working relationship with the filmmakers on this project. In May, he inquired about getting permission to film at Langley headquarters, at the palace itself. Well, they're a bit reluctant about that. But he was able to, in the following month, get he and several of the production crew to have another trip to the headquarters. And after that, he sent off another email to which the public affairs officer responded and said, well, we're trying. We're trying. And then he threw this in. He says, oh, and by the way, you know, after Affleck and his crew toured the area, he says, you definitely gave our new hires something to call home about. Isn't that impressive? They get just a mutual admiration society between Hollywood and the CIA, right? So Affleck and production designer Sharon Seymour and the executive producer kept following up. They kept trying to get permission to film inside the Langley campus of the old headquarters building. It was only after several script reviews that permission was granted, leading the deputy director for public affairs to write an email effusively thanking them for this. He described Argo as, quote, a good news CIA story with real-life CIA good guys. Affleck shot back. He says, this is great. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled. Please let me know whatever I can do. This is a thrill. We will do the agency proud. I promise you. Dr. Brian Cranston, after they gave them permission, was given a tour of the facility in October. He met with CIA officers to learn about, quote, how their lives work, keeping secrets, and the effects on their home life. And then Brian Cranston recalled that the shoot itself was a day of, quote, top security, and I do mean top. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting things about the story. Listen to this. He recounted a moment when two SPS officers from the CIA's internal police came round a corner while they were shooting inside Langley, and he asked them if everything was okay, and one told him, one of the cops says, there's a Samsung phone on in one of these two gentlemen's pockets. Brian Cranston said the fact that he knew the brand of the phone and exactly where it was through the electronic surveillance was really amazing. And the screenwriter, Chris Terrio, echoed this, describing, he said, I remember as the shoot was wrapping up, there were people who were scanning and debugging the hallway that we had been in, just to make sure that Hollywood didn't plant any bugs. Why? Because that's exactly what the CIA would do if you get around these guys. It's projection. It's theatrical projection. No. It's exactly what they would. They know what they would do. If they got anywhere near you, they would load you up with bugs and surveillance stuff. But they're doing it publicly everywhere now. Then they gave them the trailer. And at this time, you had David Petraeus, the CIA director. And so they said, well, the trailer's been making the rounds here, and everybody from the boss on down loves it, and we're really excited. And so they had a special screening for David Petraeus and a group of CIA officers before the film's general release. But the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about this, the RT article, they point out that it wasn't just the CIA's opinion that it had a major positive influence on their public image. A 2014 study found that the opinions of government agencies and levels of trust in the government and faith in the general direction of the country all improved after watching Argo and a similar CIA-supported film, Zero Dark Thirty. Meanwhile, the FBI has got its own narratives going. As John Whitehead, Rutherford Institute, points out, to fight crime, the FBI sponsors 15 crimes a day. Almost every tyranny, he writes, being perpetrated by the U.S. government against its citizenry, purportedly to keep us safe and the nation secure, has come about as a result of some threat that was manufactured in one way or the other by our own government. Cyber warfare, terrorism, biochemical attacks, the nuclear arms race, surveillance, the drug wars, domestic extremism, the COVID-19 pandemic, in almost every instance, the U.S. government, usually spearheaded by the FBI, has, in its own typical Machiavellian fashion, sown the seeds of terror, domestically and internationally, to expand its own totalitarian power. Here are some examples. Who is the biggest black market buyer and stockpiler of cyber weapons? In other words, malware. Well, that'd be the U.S. government. Who is the largest weapons manufacturer and exporter in the world, literally arming the world? Well, that's the U.S. government. Which country has a history of secretly testing our dangerous weapons and technologies on its own citizens? Well, that would be the U.S. government. Which country has conducted secret experiments on an unsuspecting populace, citizens and non-citizens alike, making healthy people sick by spraying them with chemicals, injecting them with infectious diseases, exposing them to airborne toxins. Again, the U.S. government. What country has a pattern and practice of entrapment that involves targeting vulnerable individuals, feeding them propaganda, know-how, and weapons intended to turn them into terrorists and then arresting them as part of an elaborately orchestrated counterterrorism sting? Are you noticing a pattern here? Yeah, it's the U.S. government. Are you getting the picture yet, he says? The U.S. government isn't protecting us from terrorism. The U.S. government is creating the terror. It is the source of the terror. So why is the government doing this? Well, of course, money, power, domination. We're not dealing with a government that exists to serve its people. We're not dealing with a government that exists to protect liberty and to ensure happiness. These are the diabolical machinations of a make-works program carried out on an epic scale, whose only purpose is to keep the powers that be permanently and profitably employed. Far from being tough on crime, FBI agents are also among the nation's most notorious lawbreakers, whether they're planting undercover agents in churches, synagogues, and mosques, or issuing fake emergency letters to gain access to Americans' phone records, using intimidating tactics to silence Americans who are critical of the government, or persuading impressionable individuals to plot acts of terror, then entrapping them. The nation's secret police force is a well-dressed thug, flexing its muscles and doing the boss's dirty work. For example, this is the agency that used an undercover agent, an informant, to seek out and to groom an impressionable young man, cultivating his friendship, gaining his sympathy, stoking his outrage over the injustices perpetrated by the U.S. government, then enlisting his help to blow up Herald Square subway station. Despite that, he ultimately refused to plant a bomb at a train station. He was arrested, nevertheless, for conspiring to do so at the urging of his FBI informant and used to bolster the government's track record of foiling terrorist plots. Again, Judge Andrew Napolitano has talked about this repeatedly. All of these were known, which is why we see that the government is constantly fostering this and then using this to make themselves heroes and to justify more intrusions into our lives and a bigger budget so they have more agents to do this type of thing. Which is why I said, leading up to and on the morning of January the 6th, it's going to be agent provocateurs. It's going to be people directly working for the FBI. That's why I'm not surprised. I didn't even bother really cover that article much. I mentioned it Friday, I think. Even reading a newspaper article is now enough to get you flagged for surveillance by the FBI. The agency, of course, last week we saw, served a subpoena on USA Today to provide the internet addresses and mobile phone information for everybody who had read a news story online on a particular day at a particular time about a shooting of FBI agents. This is how desperate they are. This is the danger of allowing the government to carry out widespread surveillance, stings, and entrapment operations. So was January the 6th a sting? Who was it that was organizing all of these things? Who was it that was bragging about a sting involving the election months earlier? Well, that would be Alex Jones and Steve Pachinik, right? Who was it was talking about tens of thousands of troops stationed before that actually happened? You see, when you write fiction to make the CIA look good, you typically are also writing fiction to deceive people. You had Candace Owens get a big response back. She said you have Rachel Maddow, who puts out conspiracy theories and sells them as the truth. And then you have Alex Jones who talks about the truth and makes it sound like a conspiracy theory. Why is that? Well, she was trying to defend Alex Jones. I'm not. Because I think when you add false details to the truth, when you make the truth look unbelievable, because you either want money or because you're working for somebody, I think that is suspicious, to say the least. USA Today estimates that agents have authorized criminals to engage in as many as 15 crimes a day. Some of these informants are getting paid astronomical sums. One particularly unsavory fellow, later arrested for attempting to run over a police officer, was actually paid $85,000 for his help to lay the trap in one of these schemes. The FBI has also repeatedly sought to expand its invasive hacking power to allow agents to hack into any computer anywhere in the world. For years now, the U.S. government has been creating what one intelligence insider referred to as a cyber army capable of offensive attacks. As Reuters pointed out in 2013, even as the U.S. government confronts rival powers over widespread internet espionage, it has become the biggest buyer in a burgeoning gray market where hackers and security firms sell tools for breaking into computers. As a matter of fact, they even have their own organization down in San Antonio where, for targeted individuals, they'll intercept computers as they're being shipped to that individual. You know, say you order it online, configure it online and have it ordered and sent to you. And they will intercept it and they will put their stuff to listen to it inside before it reaches you. Governments like government agencies, well, they are governments, like the NSA has been stockpiling all kinds of nasty malware, viruses, and hacking tools to steal financial account passwords. What could they do with that? Oh, you know, they can make a lot of money on their own. It's kind of interesting, you know, when we see how these people who worked for the CIA when they retire, how these made men are made wealthy. We had a lieutenant governor here who shut down the efforts by a real honest conservative libertarian to stop the manhandling of children at airports. They had unanimously a bill to stop that. And it was shut down by the lieutenant governor, a guy who was former CIA, who, after he got out of the CIA, was set up in the oil business by the Bushes and their family. He spent more money to get elected lieutenant governor than any other politician in the history of Texas. And then it paid off for them as he made sure that they were continually able to do the TSA surveillance. The NSA was responsible, writes Whitehead, for the threat posed by the WannaCry or the WannaDecryptor malware worm, which, as a result of hackers accessing the government's arsenal, hijacked more than 57,000 computers and crippled healthcare, communications, infrastructure, logistics, and government entities in more than 70 countries. Mind you, the government was repeatedly warned about the dangers of using criminal tactics to wage its own cyber wars. It was also warned about the consequences of blowback should its cyber weapons get into the wrong hands. Kind of like the bioweapon programs that are repeatedly done by Fauci that all the Republicans turn a blind eye to, that continues to go on at the bio labs that was shut down for a period of time. But again, they continued it at UNC Chapel Hill and in China. But now we only are concerned about China, not even about UNC Chapel Hill, and certainly not about the 200 plus biosafety level 3 and 4 labs. We're not concerned about an accidental leak in the United States, only in China. We're not concerned about an ongoing bioweapons program that is part of our Operation Paperclip neo-Nazi government. Suffice to say that when and if a true history of the FBI is ever written, writes O. Whitehead, it will not only track the rise of the American police state, but it will also chart the decline of freedom in America, how a nation that once abided by the rule of law and held the government accountable for its actions has steadily devolved into a police state where justice is one-sided, where a corporate elite runs everything, where representative government is a mockery and police are extensions of the military and surveillance is rampant and privacy is extinct and the law is nothing but a tool that the government uses to browbeat people into compliance. We look at the authorization for the use of military force. Interestingly enough, you have Biden and Schumer trying to repeal this, and you have five Republicans fighting it. Those five Republicans are Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, Mike Rounds, Bill Hagerty, and Ron Johnson. And as this Reuters article points out incorrectly, the Constitution gives the power to declare war to Congress. That is true. But then this is the incorrect part. The authority has shifted to the president, however, due to the forever war authorization of the use of military force, which does not expire, including the 2002 Iraq authorization of the use of military force. That is not strictly true. What it has done is, by putting out the AUMF, They have essentially declared world war in perpetuity. That's really what is happening here. World war, a declaration of war everywhere. And that's not just outside of America. That's including America as well. The CIA, the FBI, our government, and the Congress gave them this power, have declared war on everyone, foreign and domestic. And it is an unending war. And the Republicans don't want it to end either. So that is the reality. Now, a message, I think, of... I don't know if it's hope. I don't know if Ammon Bundy has any hope of winning. But there's a lot of articles being written about Ammon Bundy. Most of them are smears and lies by the mainstream media. I think the most honest assessment that I've seen is on WND. And they said they focused on what he said, why he was going to run, as opposed to doing smears about his past that are untrue. You know, you typically say, well, he's not even allowed in the Capitol building. Why is that? Well, then they lie to you about why that is. These are people who are protesting. He was passively, peacefully reading the Constitution to them. And they declared an early close and took him out in handcuffs. And then when he went for his trial date many months later, they gave him a ticket for both failure to appear when he appeared and for trespassing because he wouldn't wear a mask. They said, well, you're not going to come in here because you're not going to wear a mask. And so we're going to call that failure to appear, even though he was there. And then they gave him a trespassing ticket because he was there with a mask. This is the kind of Kafkaesque lies that you can expect from a state that is run by a Republican governor, Brad Little, and a Republican legislature. They will not stand up for your basic liberties. So this is why Ammon Bundy is running. He said he announced his run after seeing untold corruption in Idaho's government. His website lists the top five reasons to support him. Number one, he says he'll remove the property tax, because if you don't remove the property tax, folks, you'll never own any property. You're just renting it from the crown, if you will. Right? Remove the property tax. Remove personal income taxes. You don't need them in a state government, especially if you make the state government small enough that it actually... is focused on defending liberty. So remove the property taxes, personal income taxes, selling all federal land in Idaho, and signing an executive order to end abortion. Very important. That's where we began this news segment. You don't have to do what Abbott did, which is to say, I've got a law here, and it says as soon as the Supreme Court gives us permission, we will outlaw abortion. No, the Ninth and Tenth Amendment says the federal government is a creature of the states. The states created the federal government, and they delegated certain powers, not rights. States don't have rights. The federal government has no rights. Of course, neither do we as individuals in 21st century America really have any recognized rights anymore. But rights belong to individuals. Government entities have powers that are granted to them by the people. And the federal government has powers that are granted to it by the people and by the states. That's very clear in the Constitution. And that means that the federal government does not have the authority to make these declarations. And we have traitors within the federal government as well as the state government, like Greg Abbott, who have turned over that power to them and worship the supremacy of the Supreme Court. That's not constitutional at all, and it's very dangerous to have a top-down government, especially where the very top of the government is run by unaccountable, unelected people. But again, the real government is the CIA. The courts are the ones who are really our legislature, our unelected legislature. So those are four of them. The fifth one, he said, he promised to implement a system of restitution and restoration laws where victims of crimes can get their stolen property back. I mentioned this a few weeks ago. I didn't know he was going to do this. I said, you know, a lot of people will criticize the Mosaic Law, the law of Moses in the Old Testament, say, well, that's pretty harsh, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Well, if you look at it compared to the other laws that there were at the time, that was a proportionality, because most of the time, most of the other laws, they would just kill people for a crime. They were saying, no, we're going to keep this proportional. But Also, it had something that in our enlightened, quote-unquote, age, we do not do, and that is victim restitution. Ammon Bundy puts it this way. If somebody steals your iPhone, it must be immediately returned to you, along with a judgment in your favor for an additional 20% of the value to it. It's just that simple. That would be real justice. Instead, what do we have? Somebody steals your iPhone. If the government does anything about it, they will send the person to jail. They will charge you to keep them in a cage. They may also charge the person a fine. They will keep the fine. You'll get nothing. You'll get no restitution whatsoever. Instead, you'll get a bill to keep people in prison. And the people running the prisons, in many cases, are private prisons who use the prisoners as slave labor. As I pointed out yesterday, we're talking about Juneteenth, and you talk about the 13th Amendment. It says, slavery shall not exist except as punishment for a crime. And so since then, you've had these private prisons especially being operated as plantations, using slave labor, not only getting the money to house these people from the government, from the taxpayers, but also to use them as slave labor. He had this to say, I won't bore you, said Ammon Bundy, I won't bore you with the typical platitudes from politicians about how they're strong conservatives. I'm tired of our freedoms being taken from us. And I'm tired of the corruption that is rampant in our own state government. He claimed in his announcement that the deep state controls Democrat President Joe Biden, that Biden will take away America's gun rights and freedom of religion and parental rights. Absolutely. He says, they're going to take away your gun rights, freedom of religion, parental rights, and more, that further isolate the violate the Constitution in unimaginable ways, even more so than they've already done. We cannot afford to have state leadership that lets the federal government bully us or walk all over us or kill tens of millions of babies. One of his five platforms. They, unlike the other people who have conducted character assassination, slander, twisted the facts, at least WND gives it an honest assessment. They said the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, he and others were acquitted of charges. And he says on his site that he never broke the law, that he was trying to stop corrupt government officials who were attempting to steal his neighbor's land. And contrary to popular media accounts, he said, we had the support of local people who were there, and we never broke a single solitary law. Let that sink in. We never broke any laws, he says on his website. But as we were talking about the FBI, it was the FBI who shot LaVoy Finicum in the back, who shot into the car when nobody was, shooting at them. That was proven. We've seen the films. And you know where they were headed? LaVoy Finicum, when he was murdered by the FBI, he was headed to a public hearing about federal government overreach. And that public, not a public hearing, but a public meeting, that public meeting was being sponsored by a local sheriff. So the FBI shot him in the back. All right, we're going to be back in just a few minutes. Eric Peters is going to be joining us, and we will be talking about the Green New Deal and how they are using this to take away automobiles. It's amazing. We've been telling you, Eric Peters and I have been telling you about this for quite some time, and now it's becoming reality. And we'll also take a look at other issues of liberty and freedom of mobility. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show or at thedavidknightshow.com to donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family. All right, welcome back, and joining us now on the line is Eric Peters, epautos.com, and we're going to talk about some of the things that we said before. No surprise, unfortunately, we were right about what is happening with cars and the war on mobility. But how are you doing, Eric?
I'm pretty good. I'm not in a prionic haze. However, I have been watching the intro to the old $6 Million Man TV show. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking about doing a riff on the Joe Sixpack. We can make him slower than he was before. More suggestible. We have the technology.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. They've demonstrated that over this last year, haven't they? You put him on the couch, you put a mask on him, starve him of oxygen, and he gets to become even more of an epsilon than he was before.
Yes, exactly. Brave New World reference for those not familiar, and I commend reading that book if they have not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they've already experienced it now, so I mean, it's kind of it's kind of passe,
yeah.
Right?
But you know, the reference for those who don't get it, I'm referring to what appears to be a rash of really foggy driving. Now, we've always had people who drove at or just below the speed limit, and people like you and I who like to drive. Would express frustration with that. But I am seeing now regularly, literally almost every single time that I go out for a drive, these people who are going 15, 20 miles an hour below the speed limit and randomly slowing down, then randomly accelerating, wandering across the double yellow. And I'm wondering if there is a correlation between this sort of foggy, prionic driving and whatever is in those needles that people have been receiving lately.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll know soon enough, won't we? Because
we
think
will.
About a year with the last joint venture of Moncef Slaoui and Fauci when they put out Pandemrics. And about a year into it, you had a lot of children. Showed up first in the children, narcolepsy, where they just instantly fall asleep. But then also catalepsy, which is kind of freezing, right? And, you know, that is something that's it's a very rare condition, but it's been used as a plot device in a lot of fiction and Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart and other things like that. The guy would have just freeze up and it looked like he was dead. And so he was very concerned that somebody's going to bury him alive. But it's been in Arthur Conan Doyle, used it in a Sherlock Holmes thing and so forth. But it's been around for a long time. It's very rare, but it wasn't that rare once people got the strange vaccine from Moncef Slaoui and Fauci that was rushed to market without any testing. Who would imagine that something like that could happen? Anything can happen with these vaccines. It's absolutely amazing.
Sure.
Those were not even mRNA vaccines like we're seeing now.
Sure, and we don't know. You know, that's the startling thing. Nobody knows. Not Fauci. Well, unless, you know, he's not letting us in on something. But the point is there has been no long-term testing, so nobody can really know. And so it makes me wonder about this push, this bum's rush, particularly with regard to kids, who stand essentially nil risk from the Rona, and yet we have demonstrable factual proof because a number of kids have died from receiving the jab. Now, granted, it's not a huge number of them, but nonetheless, they have died, and there is no question that there is a potential serious risk associated with this vaccine. Meanwhile, there is essentially no risk to them from this Rona. So, you know, I think a reasonable person would say, well, wait a minute, maybe we should stop needling these kids until we know more and figure out what's going on with these vaccines.
Yeah, the key word here is emergency, isn't it? We have the emergency use authorization from the FDA. It's not approved except for an emergency, but it's not an emergency for the kids because their own data says that there's no threat to the kids from this. So it's not an emergency for the teens. It's not an emergency for the ones that are even younger, going all the way down to the toddlers that they're now doing their quote-unquote test on. It's not an emergency for them. So they shouldn't be authorized to use it on the kids. At the very
least,
you ought to acknowledge that. But it's absolutely amazing to me that they would roll this thing out with all of the negative indications that we've had, all the medical professionals who were talking about this, their own database showing this. They're still forging full speed ahead on the warp speed thing.
And you contrast that with every hysterical, exaggerated, over-the-top response to asserted possible risk that we experienced over the last year. juxtaposed against this actual risk. What's the number now? Something like 5,300 people have died coincident to being vaccinated.
Oh, it's up to 6,000 just in the U.S. alone. As a matter of fact, if you look at, and this is interesting, I didn't get into the vaccines yet today, mm-hmm. Eric, but you know, when you look at what is happening here in Europe, they have one database for 27 of the 50 countries in Europe, right? So out of the 27 mm-hmm. of the 50 countries, they've had reported 15,472 dead, 1.5 million injured, 50% of those seriously.
Yeah.
And so when you have the CDC's database of VAERS, that's up to 6,000 dead reported. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, first of all, anybody can report the thing. And you probably got some of those anti-vaxxers out there who are mm-hmm. flooding this with fake reports. Well, that's a crime if you do that. Mm-hmm. But it also, right. you see that the same thing is happening in the 27 European countries, the same thing is happening in the UK that is happening in the US with the CDC VAERS database. I don't think that's being mm-hmm. Manipulated in all these different databases at the same time. But, of course, these people are coincidence theorists, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and again, juxtapose that against this business of associating the death of practically everybody who died last year with the Rona, including yeah. there was one case of, I think the guy was 25 years old and he wrecked his motorcycle, and mm-hmm. they attributed that to the corona.
Yeah, and even when the guy was called out, even when the local health official was called out on it, he said, well, could be.
Right. It's a really fascinating cognitive dissonance. And,
yeah.
It's difficult for me to comprehend it because, of course, I'm one of those old-timey people like yourself who actually bases what I think on facts. And the logical extrapolation of facts, but that I guess is becoming a lost art, right up there with alchemy.
Well, and we also, I think, were able to understand what this was because you and I have been talking about the assault on our liberty to move about freely, basically
yep.
the private automobile, and where that's coming from, the climate agenda that's there, and now we have coming from Off Guardian. Kit Knightley, talking about the fact that you have a WHO economist has now put out a report and is being pushed around by all these elitist organizations, talking about a climate lockdown. It was always mm-hmm. the same agenda. It didn't matter if we were mm-hmm. going to have the polar ice caps melt or if we were going to have the entire world turn into a block of ice. They've had both of those things. The response to this and what we need to do to stop the alarmism was to surrender our cars, to stop eating meat and all this sort mm-hmm. of thing. And then same thing happened with the pandemic. And now they're coming back and talking mm-hmm. about, well, you know, we don't want to do a climate lockdown. But, you know, we just may have to come down there and do that, kids, if you don't get your room in order. And this means that you're going to have to do mm-hmm. these types of things preemptively, or we will lock you down and we will take away your meat. We'll take away your automobiles and everything else.
Yeah, they were not able to mass hystericize the climate crisis to the degree that they have been successful in hystericizing sickness.
Yes.
I think that they had to revisit their agenda in that it wasn't working. They were trotting out emotionally damaged children like that Greta Thunberg girl, and most people weren't buying it. I think they weren't buying it because to one degree or another, people would look outside and realize, you know what, the Earth isn't dying.
Yep.
The climate seems fine. I can remember it last summer. I can remember what the summer was before that. They didn't buy in. They didn't get the boogeyman fever. But, you know, with the fear campaign about the virus, they were able to just terrorize the population and get them to accept what heretofore had been unacceptable. And now the really worrisome thing is that precedent has been set. And
yes.
I agree with you. I think that they're going to use that precedent to enforce these climate lockdowns that they're talking about.
That's right. They're converging, and they're going to come back and say, we have to do this for your health. They're going to turn the climate thing they're going to personalize it into your health. They're going to use this as a medical dictatorship. And again, like you were just saying, with the climate, you look out there and you go, well, this is no big deal. The weather hasn't really changed. People don't look outside and say, well, this is not a pandemic. I know when there's a pandemic. I know when there's something going around with the school kids and with the, you know,
yep.
my kids, and they're all saying, yeah, there's a virus going around, so we're canceled the homeschool cooperative because everybody's puking this week. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yep.
you pick it up again in 2 weeks. You know when something like that's happening. You don't have to turn on the local news. You don't have to turn on the national or the global news to know that's happening. And when you've got a pandemic that you can't see unless it happens to them, and, of course, we've had a lot of people who have, because of the financial incentivization of medical malpractice, you do have people
mm-hmm.
who were brought into the hospitals, not given appropriate medical care, and murdered in the hospitals
yep.
because they got a big bonus from Trump.
Absolutely. from The Orange Man, exactly yeah. right, who, by the way, stood there like a wooden orange Indian for 6 months while Dr. Fauci served as the de facto president and fearmonger-in-chief.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I call Trump the sorcerer's apprentice.
Exactly what he is. You know, I used to think he was just a stumble bum, but I've wheeled around to think that he's complicit in this,
yes,
actively complicit.
I agree. Actively complicit. Talking out of both sides of his mouth at the same time he's doing this. And as I was just telling Karen this morning, I said, you know, he throws this stuff out, and I think he does this simply because it's a negotiating tactic. You know, throwing out stuff to both sides is who's going to pony up with the most money. We had RFK Jr. Met with him as he was in his transition team, and the big pharmaceutical companies went hysterical. They yep. sent his organizations a lot of money, and then lo and behold, we had Alex Azar, who was the CEO of Eli Lilly, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies, one of the best connected politically pharmaceutical companies in Washington. He gets put in as HHS head. And if you go mm-hmm. back 2 years, Eric, I just showed this yesterday. If you go back 2 years and look at what they were saying about the flu vaccine, and how they were pumping up the numbers and the dangers and the hesitancy and all this other kind of stuff, yep. and all these people are just afraid of needles. All of this is being done by Fauci, by Alex Azar,
yep.
by this the same people who have done this to us this last year. It's like a recurring script. It's like deja vu all over again, and I am sick and tired of it. I knew this a year ago because I've been covering
yep.
it for years.
Yep.
The same
yep,
exact
me too.
Approaches.
The cynicism of it, the disingenuousness of it, you know, RFK is on the left, but I like the guy. I respect the guy.
He's honest.
I think he's an honest,
yeah.
straight-shooting guy.
Exactly.
You can have a conversation with him, and he's not an oily shyster like Trump is and like so many of these other people are.
Yes. Yeah, he's like Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi. There's a lot of things that I
yep.
disagree with him because they're on the left,
yep.
but they're honest. And because they're
yep.
honest, they're being called, you know, conservative, Republican double agents or whatever. I mean,
isn't that amazing? Yeah, RFK, he's a conservative double agent.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolute insanity. But let's talk about some of the insanity that's here. And there is also
yep.
a ray of hope. In Switzerland, they have just rejected a climate change agenda. And it is the younger people, the Zoomers and the Millennials, who led the mm-hmm. way, according to this report, went down in flames, especially led by the 18 to 34-year-old voters, because when push came to shove and they were told that they were going to have massive sacrifices mm-hmm. and that things were going to be taken away from them, like cars, like meat, like many of these other issues, a car fuel levy, and attacks on airline tickets and controls on what they were going to eat, in order to meet the Paris Climate Agreement, they said no. And that's an encouraging sight there. I hope that can happen
very much
here.
So, particularly when I think they connected the dots and realized, okay, they're going to take all of these things away from us, and they're going to give them to the Charles Schwabs of the world.
That's
you
right.
know, this whole begged question of you will own nothing and like it. Well, it begs the question, who will own everything? And it turns out to be the same people who are demanding sacrifices of ordinary people.
Yes, yes. And they pointed out, you know, they said, look, even your own data shows that Switzerland is providing 0.1% of global emissions. So
yeah,
why are we even involved in this
and
discussion?
Nuclear over there, I think.
What's that?
Purely their grid, their electrical grid is almost entirely hydroelectric and nuclear,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah. So, you know, they're not really contributing anything. And even the people who buy into this climate alarmism, the alarmist environmentalists, are looking at this and saying, why are we giving China and India a free pass for decades? Because
sure.
they're the biggest polluters. They're allowed to put up as many and as dirty a power plants as they wish with no cap. We're capped, and
mm-hmm.
we have to start reducing before they even get a cap on this. And
mm-hmm.
I'll say one more thing, Eric, and that is at any point in time with this Paris Climate quote-unquote treaty, that's what it is, you had Barack Obama and John Kerry say we're going to self-ratify this. You could have had the Republican Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, at any point in time say, no, 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 that's the Senate's job. We're going to hold a vote. And they could have voted it down. And they could have even
yep.
voted it down. I had Mark Morano on my program after the election and said, look, this is all going to go to the Democrats because they're not going to change anything about the election rules in Georgia. So the Democrats are going to be in charge of the Senate as well as the House and the presidency. So you better stop this thing right now. So Mitch McConnell, you need to finally called us in for a vote and shut this thing down, put a stake in the heart of it. And Mitch McConnell never would, because it's the Republicans who are on board with this as well. They just pretend that they are.
Of course. Of course. It's of a piece with repeal and replace Obamacare.
Yeah, exactly.
Not get rid of it. Just give it, you know, provide a new plan of our managerial overlords that we'll have no choice to say no to.
Yeah. Well, we have complete control of our health care now, don't we? How's it looking for everybody? How you like government health care so far?
I'll close on this topic with one observation, which is that the Republican Party historically is not the party of liberty. It is the party of Lincoln that waged war in half the country to destroy the concept of government by consent of the people, by the people.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And while we're talking about that, you have an a short article on epautos.com. Presidents, tell people your take on presidents. Mm-hmm. I liked it.
Well, you know, you have to be above a certain vintage, as you and I are, to remember a time when there was an American president and there were premiers and general secretaries in these other countries around the world. And it was a healthy distinction between something that was nominally elected by at least some of the people and subject to some accountability in that sense, as opposed to sort of a dictator personality, somebody who wore epaulets and sashes and stood on the Lenin mausoleum and waved arthritically to the crowds. Well, now all of a sudden everybody's a president. And it's ironic because everybody's effectively a general secretary or premier now. You know, we have these executives who walk around in business suits now without the epaulets and sashes, but effectively they're dictators. You know, under our system of government, the president was supposed to be a kind of an administrator. The Congress was supposed to write laws limited in scope by the authority granted in the Constitution, and the president's role was to administer these limited laws. Now, I mean, he's a de facto decreer. You don't even use the words executive action, executive orders. Those are decrees, aren't they?
Yes.
No laws have been passed. They're just hurling out these things, and we're somehow obliged to obey what these elected dictators say, and it's a remarkable transformation.
Well, I was talking about gun control, about the red flag gun laws, and of course, you know, we had Trump say, well, you know, we're going to just take the guns and do the due process later, and then he went through and did executive order gun control with a bump stock, and everybody said, well, it's just a bump stock, it doesn't matter. The important thing was the precedent that was being set. And so now
Biden
doing that for other attachments, but talking about doing executive order gun control, left and right. And so I think that they need a new title, Eric. I think these guys are not in control anymore. Let's not call them presidents. Let's call them precedents.
that's an excellent suggestion. Yeah, right. They're factotums who issue precedents for the next precedent to come down the pike. That's right.
Well, when we talk about where we're headed with this, one of the things that the Biden administration is now moving very quickly on, and the corporations, the corporate presidents are responding to this very favorably, happy about this, and that is the restructuring of our infrastructure by booty marks. So, you know, I used to call him Pete Booty Gay because he's very proud of the fact that he's gay, but he tries to hide. Yep. He's still in the closet as far as a Marxist goes, right? And he is a Marxist. He's a trained Marxist. His father's entire career as a university professor was about Marxism. He made sure that Booty Gay or Booty Marx went to study under Sokvan Berkovich, who was so into communism that he changed his first name to honor Sacco and Vanzetti. And everything that he wrote said that all the ills of America and of the world could be laid at the feet of the pilgrims who came here and the Christian ethics, right? So that's where Booty Gay is coming from, Booty Marx. And so Biden puts him in charge of infrastructure. And what they want to do is have a centrally controlled infrastructure via electrification. And they have a massive amount of money that they're talking about putting out, $174 billion. I looked up to see how much the entire interstate system cost that was built out over a period of 35 years. The entire interstate system in today's dollars was $500 billion. They're going to spend $174 billion in just a couple of years to try to set up an infrastructure for electric cars and to give more and more subsidies to the car manufacturers to make sure that they don't build any more gasoline and diesel cars, and they're taking them up on it.
That's right. And there's another common denominator here again is this dishonesty. You know, they use that word, infrastructure, but it's not that. Infrastructure historically has meant just what you said, the interstate highway system, roads, bridges, and so on. And now they're reframing that and redirecting the money that was supposed to have gone for infrastructure, things that allow people to get around conveniently and affordably, into things that are inconvenient and unaffordable, which is precisely why the government has to sluice the money in that direction using the power, the force that it has, because it's not what most people want, because it's not useful to them.
That's right. And everything about this new infrastructure is also focused on surveillance and on control. And that begins inside your car, surveillance and control of your car, and from the outside, surveillance and control of that, but making sure that they know everything that you're doing, everywhere that you're going, and that you're not going to own anything, because they're going to set this thing up on a rent-by-ride basis, as you and I have been talking about for years. And so now the federal government is going to heavily, heavily subsidize this. Audi has said that they are going to be all electric by 2026. So in 5 years, they're not going to make any more gasoline or diesel cars at all. No more internal combustion engines. They are going to do everything electric. And, of course, it's going to be battery-operated electric. It's not even going to be hydrogen electric where they could charge you at the pump. No, they're going to have to surveil you so that they can give you a tax-by-mile fee.
Yeah, they've also announced that they're not spending any more money developing their existing engine technologies or lines. They're just abandoning it completely. So, basically, they're obsoleting everything that uses internal combustion engines from their product portfolio. And I'm not surprised that they're doing this, because the strictures that are in place, the regulatory strictures that are in place as far as emissions, as far as gas mileage FOTWAs, are becoming impossible to comply with for them.
Yeah. But I think they're also on board with that to a great degree, because, you know, those real expensive and complicated emission control situations, that also ups the entry level for people who want to compete against them, right?
Well, no question.
The electric cars are very easy for somebody like Tesla to immediately come in, because it's a very simple. You got a roller skate essentially with batteries at the bottom and motors on the wheels. In terms of just the motivation aspect of it, that's part of it, is very simple. And so they have to get into this pretty quickly to try to cut that off. But it's also all of the safety regulations that are out there. That was a barrier to entry for people who wanted to come in and compete with them.
Well, sure, and fundamentally, why sell something when you can force people to buy it?
Yes.
You know, that's the other thing that's driving this. Right now, you and I aren't compelled to go out and buy an electric car, but the government is going to make it such that you have to buy one. And not only that, you're going to have to help other people buy electric cars via the taxes that you pay that are used to provide all of these massive subsidies. They're talking about bringing back that $7,500 per vehicle subsidy that did sunset after a manufacturer built, I think it was 200,000 of these things. Tesla made enormous amounts of money off of that.
Yeah.
And they want to keep that boodle flowing. And they want to get you, most of all, on the revolving debt plan. They want you paying a monthly fee forever, a fee like you do with your cell phone. You don't own it. You rent it for a period of time. And they have operational control of the thing.
Yes. Everything is about you will always be a renter. And again, it goes back to Klaus Schwab bragging about how you'll own nothing. You'll rent everything from them, and they will allow you to live your life as a privilege granted to you by corporations. And we can see what this looks like if you look at social media and free speech. But when we're talking about their whole business model, Eric, there is an article that came out a couple of days ago, that came out on Sunday, talking about how the cars on the U.S. highway hit a record age. The average age is now 12.1 years. And I remember when I was back in high school, Volvo was running ads talking about how they were bragging about the fact that in Sweden, the average age of the car was 12 years. And, of course, part of that was, you know, taking a hit at the planned obsolescence of American corporations. But we used to laugh at that and say, well, it's because they're under heavy socialism and taxes and they can't afford a new car.
Right.
But now that's where we are. And so is that a wonderful point? That's they've put us into something that is probably worse than what Sweden had back in the 1970s in terms of socialism.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of aspects to this. One is kind of ironic. The reason that the average car is 12 years old is because the average car is so durable and reliable now.
Yes.
And the reason for that has to do with all of the pressure to comply with these federal FOTWAs and regulations, especially with regard to emissions. So the manufacturing tolerances had to be tightened up. Fuel management system had to be very precise. And they built these cars to hew to all of these standards. And the upside to that for us is that they pretty much run forever. It's routine for a gasoline-powered car to go 200,000, 250,000 miles, which in the past was the kind of mileage you got out of a diesel, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you get it out of a gas engine car. So people are naturally hanging on to their vehicles for longer. And a lot of them are doing so, in my opinion, because they've looked into what new cars are like, both in terms of their expense and in terms of their creepy, peremptory, big brothery, nannying technology, which they're all suffused with. And a lot of people, and I talk to a lot of people all around the country, simply say, you know what, I want no part of that. I'm going to cling to my older car for as long as I possibly can.
That's right. That's right. And again, the disruption in supply lines has meant that there is a semiconductor shortage. There was an article a couple of weeks ago. A guy said, I drove by this Ford dealership that usually has about 1,500 cars, and the lot was empty. I thought they were out of business. I went in. They've only got 30 cars there, and they're all sold, and they're waiting for more cars to come from the factory. And just down the road, it was one of the largest volume Ford dealerships just down the road, was the factory itself. And they are overflowing with cars because they're waiting for the final chips to come in so they can ship these things. And this is a global shortage that is happening, and this is all happening because of the corona lockdown, the global lockdown, busting the supply lines in many unpredictable ways. When I drove to New York to speak up in New York at Gerald Celente's event, one of the things I noticed, Eric, when I was driving was how many of these car trailers, you know, we have two different levels of cars and trucks, how many of them there were on the road and how they were all carrying used cars, because that's now become a big deal. And so I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, what is going on with this? Evidently, this is the car dealerships, which typically if they got a used car and they thought, well, maybe there's something a bit dodgy about this and I don't want to have the risk to my reputation of reselling a car that's kind of old and maybe not in great condition. And so they would send it off to the bullpens and let these people do it. But I think they're buying this stuff up so they got something to resell. Because I was seeing really old pickup trucks. I saw an old second-generation Miata, which is probably like 20 years old. I mean, it's just all over the place.
Without question. And this accounts for the fact that the last time I looked, which was, I guess, about a week ago, the average retail price of used cars is up 30%.
Yes, so much so they said that it's going to have an impact on inflation, because the economists in Washington had not anticipated that particular factor. If it's something that's going to be a regular occurring factor, they will take it out so they don't report inflation. But that's one thing that they hadn't factored out yet, so it's going to surprise them and affect the inflation reports. But the other part of this was they said cars on the U.S. highway hit a record age, but it may unleash a repair boom. And so I looked at that and I thought about the very thing as we're seeing Audi moving away from gasoline engines. You know that they're going to stop making parts for all this stuff as well. Maybe this is a big business opportunity for somebody that wants to go out and start doing machine manufacturing with numerical control devices of parts, because that's the kind of stuff that Jay Leno's always done for his old classic cars. He's got some guys out there who
don't have to be you don't have to be Jay Leno anymore, meaning you don't have to have his money.
Yeah.
The cost of the technology necessary to manufacture these items in your garage for the average guy has almost come down to reasonable levels. It's not that far removed from having your own paint spray booth or a whole a lift in your own garage. You know, it's pricey, but it's not out of hand pricey. And people
Look at the ghost guns. Right? Look at the ghost guns where you do some 3D printing of some of the parts. I mean, are we going to have some ghost cars coming out?
it's entirely possible. I think actually there's going to be a burgeoning market, not only for the manufacture of spare parts, but for the repair of these older vehicles to keep them on the road. I wrote an article many months ago, which I called the Americano Cubano, and the reference was to cars in Cuba and how, you know, after Fidel and the communists took over, people were stuck with the cars that they had there from the 50s and the 40s and before, and they just managed to keep them going, and they're still going, even now, today, 60 years after La Revolucione.
That's right.
And I foresee such a thing happening here unless they actually outlaw it and clamp down on people who are attempting to repair and keep these older vehicles running. Because, you know, speaking for me and probably for people you know as well, I'm clinging to my 02 Nissan Frontiers for the foreseeable future, because I don't want all of this peremptory nannying, big brothery technology in a vehicle of mine.
Absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely. That, I think, is exactly what would happen, and that would happen naturally with the marketplace. But, of course, I think what's going to happen with that to keep us from having the kind of Cubano market that we've all seen is I think they're going to come after the fuel. They're going to make it very, very expensive and virtually unattainable to get the fuel, and that's going to be the big issue. So you're going to have some kind of conversion there, or as you've talked about in the past, a diesel that can burn a wide variety of a lot of different fuels can easily be adapted for that. I think that's really going to be the future. But, yeah, if you had a diesel car that you could adapt a little bit and you could set up a user community to start to create these parts, people might even find that they could have a cottage business. There's an idea for people. I'd love for somebody to pick that up and run with it because that's something we're all going to need.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree. And also with regard to distillation, because if you have an older vehicle, particularly a carbureted vehicle, a gas engine vehicle, it's not too difficult to convert one of those to run on alcohol, and it's not that difficult to produce your own alcohol at your own place.
Yes, yes. One more article I wanted to talk about with you, another kind of needling coming. Tell people what you mean by that at epautos.com, another kind of needling coming.
Yeah, this is really scary, and you're in Texas, so you'll know well what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Which are the references to these forced blood draws that they do at these sobriety checkpoints in addition to the breath test for alcohol. And the justification for it in some cases is that, well, the breath test can't detect pot, can't detect other drugs in people's system. And as you know, there has been quite a move toward decriminalization, if not outright legalization, of marijuana. So now the excuse is, well, we've got all these potheads out there who are getting high and driving. How are we going to deal with this? The breathalyzer doesn't catch them, so what are we going to do? We're going to strap them down, and we're going to draw their blood by the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just, is that not the apotheosis of living in a police state where goons can just drag you out of your car and throw you down and draw blood out of your body?
Oh, absolutely.
Right there by the side of the road.
I remember seeing that because you know, after we moved here to Texas, they started doing that at some of these places, forced blood draw. Guy did not want to do it. They hauled him off kicking and screaming. They tied him down to a gurney, and they're drawing the blood from him. I thought, what in the world is going on? You know, I mean, this is unbelievable. But, yeah, so now they're going to start doing that with pot because they can't do a breathalyzer. And then what's the other kicker about this in terms of pot and what they're going to find in your blood?
Well, you know, potentially the thing with alcohol is, you know, you drink alcohol and you're potentially affected by the alcohol for a limited amount of time. The alcohol dissipates. It's no longer in your system. But with pot, you smoke a little pot, the effects of the high, the THC, are gone pretty quickly, but the THC remains in your body for, I think, up to 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be completely straight, not high, have nothing at all impairing you, and yet still be compelled to submit to these tests and potentially be found guilty of stone driving or whatever they're going to call it. And, of course, both of these things, the drug tests and the sobriety tests, all derived from the same awful idea that it's okay in a free country to just erect these checkpoints where without any individual probable cause, any reason to suspect that you're drunk or high, you're compelled not only to stop and give your papers, but you're compelled to prove your innocence rather than have them establish your guilt.
That's right. And, you know, taking preemptive measures to protect people for their safety, how many times have we heard the left say, well, you have to wear seatbelts, don't you? And it's like, why? Does my seatbelt protect you? Do I have to wear my seatbelt so that you're protected in your car in case I hit you? I mean, that's the ridiculous part of this. But now we're talking about something that's going to be essentially a PCR test for drivers.
Yeah.
I mean, it all falls together, doesn't it?
By the way, the car manufacturers are all in on this. They're already beginning to work on it. In fact, may already have embedded or begun to embed passive alcohol and drug sensing technology in their vehicle and interlock technology. So if the vehicle detects any of that, it just doesn't start anymore as if you had been convicted of drunk driving.
Well, and it's really overkill because at the same time, they're trying to make sure that people don't have the ability or not allowed to own a car, not allowed to drive a car. But just in case all that doesn't do that, then they'll come up with some way to make it overly expensive by forcing everybody to buy a breathalyzer. Even somebody like me that doesn't ever drink, I'd have to buy a breathalyzer. And then have the ability to lock you out of your car. I mean, it's just it never ends with these people.
More onerous expenses and hassles to make driving as unpleasant and as costly as possible so as to make people just not want to do it anymore. It's just not worth it. And by the way, just to be clear, in no way am I defending people who drive drunk. I just think it's absurd that the issue isn't impairment, not why you're impaired. If you're impaired and you cause an accident, that's objective evidence that, you know, you shouldn't have been driving.
Yes.
And I'm absolutely not only okay with, but very much in favor of holding people who cause harm accountable and responsible for the harms that they cause. What I'm not in favor of is presuming that people are impaired absent any reason to believe that they are impaired.
That's right. And look at how many times in my former days, I was spent a good deal of time in traffic court for speeding tickets. And I noticed how they threw the book at me, but they but they let the people who had were repeat offenders for drunk driving, they let them go time and time and time again. And it's like, sure. And whether or not, and I guess, they let them go in some of these cases. Because they had a lawyer who was making an argument, one of them in particular, I remember, that said, well, the guy is a pilot, he's a commercial pilot, and that'll be the end of his career. And it's like, okay, well, I'll let you go so you can get drunk and fly a plane.
Right. Well, and how about this one, too? The person who has horrendous vision and who chooses to get in a car and then doesn't notice that the light has turned red, blows through the intersection and kills somebody, they're treated with relative kid gloves compared to the person who didn't hit anybody, but maybe had two beers with his supper on the way home and gets pulled over at a sobriety checkpoint.
That's right. Yeah, and they continued to redefine what drunk was, so that they could continue to take the blood alcohol level down. And it's just all these games that they're playing, but it all goes back to preemptive safety. And for your preemptive safety, we have to take everything that you have, including your liberty. And so if you want to follow Eric Peters, he's got some great real car reviews. While you're still able to get a real car, Eric has some great real car reviews there as well. I mean, he's not doing hypercars and, and praise of the electric vehicle type of stuff that you see in all the corporate press. But he's got, real family cars, and if you're in the market for one, and if you can find one that's assembled with all the parts.
Yeah, the latest one I've got up there is about the current Toyota Camry, which is the last man standing. It's the last family-priced family sedan that you can still get a V6 in, and that doesn't come with a turbocharged engine and does not have one of those awful CVT automatic transmissions.
Yes. I know. Yeah, they're all disappearing. So it's and I always look at it as a theft protection, my manual transmission.
Amen.
Thieves out there.
Set the choke. What's that?
I had a car that was a manual transmission with a choke on it. It was a Spitfire, 1974 Spitfire. And that was quite a trip. It's the car that I loved the most and hated the most at the same time. It was quite an
experience. Here's something. If you want to confuse a millennial, ask them if they know what it means to tickle the amyls. Remember that? Old British motorcycles had amyl carburetors, and you had to wiggle this little switch to get some of the fuel to drip down so the thing would start.
Yeah. Well, my Spitfire wasn't too much from that. It was about 1,500 cc, and it had a manual choke on it like a lawnmower, and it ran about like a lawnmower too. Well, it was great talking to you.
The connection that we had with cars in those days.
Yeah, it was a very raw experience. It was a lot of fun to drive, and that's why I liked about it. But it was also such a raw experience that it would leave me stranded at times.
Well, that's true, but you know what? You could usually get it back on the road yourself instead of having to pathetically tap your phone to get a truck to come haul it away.
That's right. And when Karen and I got stuck at the beach, we just enlisted the help of two or three people, and we lifted the car up off of the sand.
Yeah, they were good times. Hopefully we'll have such good times again at some point.
That's right. Yeah, now you're not even allowed to drive on the beach, so there you go. Thank you, Eric. And people, you can find great articles on liberty and mobility at epautos.com. Stay with us. We will be right back. Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family. Okay, and this morning, maybe you have seen this on Twitter. I've not retweeted this yet, or regabbed it, I guess, on Gab. But this was a thread by Adrian Rochefleisch talking about deplatforming the far right. And they included me in this chart. And what they did was they went back and they evidently got a research grant from, I don't know, from the federal government, from the Soros Foundation. Who was it that paid for this research to tell people that, guess what, if you're kicked off of YouTube and you're on BitChute, you don't get as many views. This is the conclusion of this very, very important research that these people did. We showed that deplatforming is effective in minimizing the reach of far-right channels. It cannot be compensated for on alternative platforms, and they used yours truly as one of the individuals. And, you know, it's kind of even more so, and, you know, I've had more than a 90% kill of my reach because of that. It's even more so because I'm not even allowed to promote my BitChute videos on Twitter. They block it. So I have to put up links on Twitter to YouTube, to Rumble, to Odyssey, where I put videos up. And yeah, they have essentially killed my reach. They have deplatformed me. They have taken the PayPal payments this month, Venmo as well. They have banned me from YouTube, and they're bragging about it. And they're thinking, they said, special thanks. And we have a whole list of a bunch of people in this Twitter thread. And I looked them up to see where they were from. And two of them were from Stanford. Another one was from Harvard. Another one was from Princeton. Why do you think these Ivy League schools would be coming after me? Would it be something I said? Yeah, exactly. And, of course, they also include Alex Jones in there. And I guess this is one of the things that really sticks in my craw, because Alex has been probably more effective than Google in terms of trying to limit my reach. Because by keeping channels that had my name on it for months, I had people, and half the people I met, and I didn't know you're still doing a program. I've had people who are friends, who are neighbors, who didn't know for months. Why? Because Alex kept my name, and I had to set up new channels, even on these alternative platforms. So I really do appreciate your support. And we have, as many people said at the beginning, you need to let us know how you're doing. Well, we're not doing too well, to be honest with you. We're not doing too well in terms of reach. We're not doing too well in terms of contributions. It's the same people who have generously contributed, and they do it on a regular basis. But it's a very, very small amount of people who listen to the program. And you know, if we can get people, the number of downloads that we have is approaching just off of the podcasts. It's approaching about 10,000 a day off of the two different podcast platforms, because we now have two platforms, because for several months I had one of them camped out on by Alex. So we were able to reactivate that after about 4 months. But that really hasn't gotten back up to the level that the other one that we created in the interim has gotten up to. But even if we had just a small fraction of those people giving us a $5 a month contribution, that would make the difference. So we've now put on the DavidKnightShow.com, we've now put a fuel gauge there. And as you can see that, it's only at about 30%. This month, because part of this is even some of the faithful contributors have not been able to contribute, figure out how to contribute because of PayPal. And I think another part of it was people were thinking that I had another stream of revenue out of the radio program that I do. And that basically has not worked out as I was led to believe it would. So I've done this program now for 2 months, and I've gotten not a penny from it. That was not what I was led to believe. I thought there was going to be some revenue sharing of the ads that were there. That is not happening. So just to let you know, we're going to keep updating that fuel gauge there to let you know where that's happening. But, yeah, they're bragging about the fact that they can kill 90% of your reach by kicking you off of YouTube over and over again. And even more so if they can block you entirely by camping out on your name, which is, again, what Alex Jones has done over the last year. Just before we leave, I want to say one thing that is very important to people. I didn't get into the vaccines very much yesterday or today, but I want to get this information to you because I have a lot of people asking me and a lot of pressure on people's jobs and other issues with the mandated vaccines. And I think this is a very important story. This is coming out of New York, Fox 5 New York, a Christian man fired after refusing to provide fingerprints. But that's not the real story. The headline doesn't tell you the real story. The real story is in the first sentence of the article. Federal authorities are suing the company that fired him because he refused to be fingerprinted for religious reasons. Now, that's very important because that has, even though they don't mention this, of course, in Fox News, because they're big pushers of the vaccines, that has important implications for the employer mandating you take a vaccine. It is the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, suing a Minnesota-based company on behalf of this Christian. They fired him, and instead of accommodating his request not to be fingerprinted due to his religion, the EEOC says its pre-suit investigation revealed that the company had requested its employees to be fingerprinted as a result of a background check requirement for one of its clients. The EEOC said an employee should not have to choose between his faith and his livelihood. You can take that to the bank. You can take that to a lawsuit. Even if the EEOC changes its position on this, just like OSHA changed its position. OSHA first came out, if you remember, they said, if you require your employees to get a vaccine, you will be liable for any damages that they have. And then after that started getting traction, the higher-ups came back and said, we're removing that. We're not going to say that anymore. But they've already said it. And you can say that to your employer. And you can say that in court when you sue them for firing you. And you can say that the EEOC said this about your faith as well, because there are multiple issues for Christians to object to these vaccines on. First of all, it is cannibal medicine. All of these vaccines were either researched and or manufactured using cannibal medicine, baby parts, cell lines, and so forth. But you can also make the situation that the case that to you, you believe that it is the mark of the beast. You've got multiple ways that you can push back on this thing, and you should. And so I wanted to get that information to you and to also remind you that we've now had, as I pointed out with Eric, according to the European database, 15,472 reported dead from these COVID toxic jabs, 1.5 million injured, 50% of those serious, and that is only from 27 of the 50 European countries. For example, just with Pfizer, 7,420 deaths, 560,000 injuries, and that's of the June the 19th, and they break it down by the different vaccine manufacturers. We've had the 13-year-old boy, and I didn't talk about this yesterday either. It was came out on Sunday. I retweeted it. A 13-year-old boy found dead after the second Pfizer shot. And it was absolutely amazing, the tweet that was put out by Tammy Burridges. She showed the vaccine certificate of the 13-year-old. She said, a week ago today, my brother's 13-year-old son had his second COVID shot. Less than 3 days later, he died. The initial autopsy results done Friday were that his heart was enlarged and there was fluid surrounding it. He had no known health problems and he was on no medications. And then she goes on to say that she is pro-vaccine. I struggled with putting this out on Twitter because I'm pro-vaccine. And we vaccinated our own 14-year-old son as soon as it was available. And I know it is, quote, mostly safe. But Jacob is dead now. Have others died in the U.S., or is my nephew the first? Well, there have been other reported deaths. They're just telling people that it's not killing the teens. And again, this is an emergency use authorization, and this is being given to teens and to toddlers now, for which there is no emergency, for which they cannot even make a case in their doctored numbers that there is an emergency. So she put this out. She said, I think parents should be warned of the risk, and you should be monitoring this very closely. if you give it to your child. And I think you ought to give it to your child. That's the amazing thing about this. Let me tell you, by the way, CNN reported this on Friday. They said, well, we've seen that at least seven young boys and men between the ages of 14 and 19 suffered from a very rare type of heart inflammation. That is one of the most cynical lies, and we've seen this over and over again. Remember a few, I guess a couple of months ago, where you had four different sites in four different states where you had about four dozen people immediately taken off, some of them directly to the hospital, some of them had to have treatment there, and that made the news as they were rolling out Johnson & Johnson. So they had to respond to that. The way they responded to it was they said, well, we've seen blood clotting issues, but only with six women out of 6 million. And at the time, the VAERS report showed more than 800 reported cases of that, men and women. And they said, no, it's only six and it's only women. Now CNN is telling you that there's only been seven young boys and men who have had this issue with cardiac events, and they're lying. There are 623 reports in the VAERS data. Now, is that a lot out of all the millions of people? Again, going back to the 737 MAX, did you hear when there were 356 people who died in two plane crashes of that Boeing plane 5 months apart? Did you hear them saying, well, look at all the millions of people that flew on these planes and didn't die? No. Why do we have a different standard for that? Well, it's because of people like Fauci, people like Trump, and all the presidents in between, that they've given them complete legal immunity to any of this. And they don't care how many hundreds or how many thousands or tens of thousands of people die from this, unlike an airplane. They would have grounded this a long time ago. If this was an airplane, if it was a car, if it was a crib, if it was a vacuum cleaner that was electrocuting people, just a couple of people, they would have stopped the sale of a hairdryer if you had a couple of people electrocuted. They wouldn't have said, well, look at how many people have used this hairdryer and didn't die. You understand what's going on with this. And you better not play the game that, well, I still trust them because, hey, we're just, you know, we're playing Russian roulette here. That's what we're talking about. This is not the vaccine lottery. This is Russian roulette, and you're playing it with your lives and the lives of your children. That's it for today. Thank you for listening.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.